You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Peter Beecraft. Peter, it's good to have you here.
Yes, it's good to finally be here.
So Peter, the way the show begins is with the huge question, who are you? What do we need to know about the values you aspire to live, the roles or the labels you wear? What do we need to know to start this conversation?
Ooh. Well, let's see. There's a lot of titles I have, from winemaker to father to son to husband to brother and friend. All of them have certain requirements, and I hope I live up to them. I'm a kind person. I'm fair. I can be humorous. I'm fun to be around.
So all of those titles you wear are relational.
Yeah.
So they put you with people, and you just described some of the qualities as a person you want to have in those relationships. What is it in life that you find most satisfying? What do you look for or notice first?
Sure. I like what I find satisfying in life. I like harmony. I like to work. I like to work hard at things that I love to do. I love to teach. And I love to also foster. I love the sense things that please the senses. Mm-hmm. Whether that be art or music, visual art or music or good food. I like those things. Those things make me happy.
Yeah. And I would imagine, I mean, one of the labels, I don't know if, did you list winemaker?
I did. It was the first one.
Yeah. That's funny because I got into the list.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you brought some music with you. What would you like to open the show with?
Well, why don't we do Tiny Bubbles? It's always good to start with a little sparkling.
Tiny bubbles and wine make me happy, make me feel fine. Tiny bubbles make me warm all over with a feeling that I'm gonna love you till the end of time. So here's to the golden moon, and here's to the silver sea, and mostly here's a toast to you and me. Tiny bubbles,
tiny bubbles
in the wine make me happy,
make me happy,
make me feel fine,
make me feel fine.
Tiny bubbles,
tiny bubbles
make me warm all over with a feeling that I'm gonna love you till the end of time.
Tiny bubbles,
ooh, Wally,
in the wine,
Carolina,
make me happy.
Oh, holy,
make me feel fine.
Think about in you till the end of time. Where the feeling that I'm gonna love you, gonna love you till the end of time.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Peter Beecraft. So Peter, given the life that you value living now, and the way you like to live now, what were some experiences you had to go through to know that this is how you want to show up in the world? What did you have to learn?
What did I have to learn? I had to learn not be fearful, to take risks, to know that through taking risks, you will grow. I learned to follow my passions. I learned that it's important to have people around you that support you to allow you to do that. That also gives you the support. I learned how I've gotten here, trust my intuition, and that sometimes is enhanced through experience.
What made you aware that being fearful was not helping you?
It's never good to suffer from anxiety or things like that, but it happens.
Some people do it because they can't imagine anything else.
Yeah,
what made
true.
You aware that you, could, that you that it was a problem and you could
I was made aware that at a certain point in my life where I was living my life, right? And living it to make decisions on forwarding that, as opposed to living, thinking about how I should live for others.
Right. How they might react to your choices and how you might make them happy or unhappy.
Yeah, and I think when you're younger, those kind of restraints or they're more like guidelines, railings, you know, that guardrails that keep you focused, right? And it's part of that structure of having structure when you're younger. But there comes a time where you not only graduate from schools and things like that, but you also graduate into yourself. Those moments that where you are making decisions to better yourself because you know that that's the only way you can discover yourself and lead your own life.
Yeah. So what were some of the decisions that you made, and did you run into resistance from those around you?
If I think back, it was something as simple as when I went away to school in college, right? I grew up outside of DC and in Virginia, and I went to school in upstate New York at SUNY Brockport. And it wasn't working out, but I felt like, I wasn't ready to go. I wasn't ready to leave. To make that decision after a semester, you know, those kind of things are kind of tough, especially when your parents are so excited. They've already bought all the stickers and they've already bought all the sweatshirts and stuff, and you feel like you're disappointing. So that weighs heavy on you as well. But for me, that was my first adult decision. I felt like that was the first time as an adult I made a decision for myself that I felt I needed to make, and I was making it for myself as opposed to making it for others. Now, I never had, my parents are great and extremely supportive and have been great examples in my life, and part of their intrepidness, I've gotten that by watching them. And those little events that happen, at least in my life right there, are big. And those are things, that's a moment I come back to. Another moment would have been, I lived in New York City for about 11 or 12 years. And right after 9/11, my wife and I were both living there. And the day after, we both, looked at each other and we said, you know what, life is too short to be unhappy. Life is too short to not follow your passions. And we decided at that very moment, on the 12th of September, 2001, that we were going to follow our passions and lead. We had a life, right? We had a great life there. And but
what were you doing there? What held you there?
Sure. I had gone to New York City to go to grad school at Hunter College for a Master of Fine Arts, and I had left the program. I didn't complete the program there, and I was working for a fashion photographer in his studio, and I started as a clothing presser. It was a part-time job, and to supplement while I was going to school. And then when I left, I started working there full-time as a clothing presser, steaming and pressing clothes that they used on the photo shoots. And then I became, then someone leaves and a spot opens up, and I'm a merchandising coordinator. And then someone else leaves, and now I'm a casting director. And I was just floating down the river, essentially. And one thing opened, and that's kind of how my life has evolved, kind of floating down the river there. And I was working for this photographer, made great money, around a lot of very artistic people and very creative people from all over the world. And but I was kind of unsatisfied. I was kind of losing myself, my sense of self. I had identified as an artist, and I was working around these kind of people, but I wasn't doing that. And so on the 12th of September, at that point, I was into wine. I was into wine through my wife's work. At that point, she was a pastry chef at the River Cafe. And through her job, we would go at really good restaurants. And it was through those, being a passenger with my wife and her colleagues, they find out where you're from. They say, put the menus away. We're bringing stuff out. Okay, right? And so there's really great food. And then there's really great wine paired with it. And that was kind of an aha moment for me, where I was starting to see the play of food and wine, and how transcendent it could be. And then it was, I'd studied in Italy in college, and it was bringing me back to those times, which was a very happy moment in my life, a great chapter in my life, studying in Italy. But I could see these things that were exciting me, the art in it, the connection to civilization, at that time I was looking for something that meant something to me, right? That meant something to people. And, making clothing catalogs, wasn't doing it for me. I started to get into wine that way, and that, it took a while. Took a while, but I started to just devour everything I could about it. I was hooked. And I could also see that as an artist, I could translate that into winemaking.
Yes. Well, yeah. I want to take a musical break now. We're going to come back to this theme after the song. What should we listen to now?
Why don't we go? Why don't we go with the Dean Martin song, the second one there.
Here we go. Hey brother, pour the wine.
A boy went back to Napoli because he missed the scenery, the native dances and the charming songs. But wait a minute, something's wrong. Now it's
Mambo, Mambo Italiano, hey Mambo, Mambo Italiano, go, go, go. You mixed up a Siciliano, all you Calabrese do the Mambo like a crazy with the hey Mambo. You don't wanna tarantella, hey Mambo, no more mozzarella, hey Mambo. Mambo Italiano, try an angelada with the fish, baccalà, and then hey, Goomba, my lover, how you dance to Roomba. But take some advice, paisano, learn how to mambo. If you're gonna be a square, you ain't gonna go nowhere. Hey, Mambo, Mambo Italiano, hey, Mambo, Mambo Italiano, go, go, Joe. Shake it like a Giovanna. Hello, kissy, did you get happy in the pizza when you mambo Italiano? You don't have to go to the school. Choose to make it with a beat of bambino. It's like a vino. Kid, you good looking, but you don't know what you're cooking, do you? Hey, Mambo, Mambo Italiano. Hey, Mambo, Mambo Italiano. Ho, ho, ho. You mixed up a Siciliano. Hello, kissy, did you get happy in the pizza when you Mambo Italiano?
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Peter B. Kraft. Now, when you said a couple of things that were really interesting to me, to not be fearful, to not be afraid. That was kind of the goal, but you do that by taking risks. That was interesting, and you've talked a little bit about how that the 9/11 propelled you in that direction. But you said something else that was even more interesting. And that is that you needed to have the people around you to provide the support structure or the network that kind of helps you to take those risks without completely being, I was inferring, without completely being out there, lost.
You know?
How did you, was that just part of your relationship with your wife, or how did you come to awareness that you needed to have some structure around you in relationships to take the risks that matter to you?
I think having a collaborator makes it easier. My parents were very supportive of me, and so I've been able to be very supportive of those that, you know, that are special to me. And definitely my wife is a great collaborator, and support, and we support each other, you know, both of our ways. She has a small boutique chocolate business that was a risk for her. Leaving the restaurant business and starting this small business. And, you know, I was there to support it, one, because, you know, I wanted to see her grow, but two, how cool, right? We've both been very supportive. When we finally moved up here, it, it wasn't for my chocolate, for my wife's chocolate business. It was for, I had a, an opportunity to work in the wine industry up here. And so she loved it in New York, in New York City. I mean, her life was great there, right?
But my life was great. Food opportunities there. That's
for sure. Yeah. So that was a big, that was a big move for her. And so, you know, I don't forget that. Mm-hmm. And plus if she's happy, I'm happy, and vice versa, you know? So, but you know, it all stems back to my raising. You know, my father was, both of my parents were in the military. And it would be easy for them to want me to follow in their footsteps.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a lot of you know, families that where they want that legacy,
right,
to keep it in, you know, going. And there was never any pressure. Actually, I think they probably moved me away from thinking like that. Mm-hmm. Because they didn't want to pressure me into doing that. So, and then when I say I want to be, you know, go to art school, right? So, you know, they just wanted me to be happy, right? And I could sense that. I could sense that. And I could tell that, you know, yes, they loved what they were doing. What they were doing wasn't necessarily what they thought I should be doing.
Yeah.
As long as you're happy.
Right. But, and one of the really important ingredients of what you have just described is that you did not feel fearful or ashamed or hesitant to share what you really wanted to do and what you wanted to go for, or what you wanted to go for with your wife, or what she wanted to go for with your support. And those kinds of conversations have to happen in a lot of detail before people can really get on board with each other. I think we overlook that fact. I'm going to take just 1 second longer here. What you've described as collaboration in the way that you've done it sounds like covenant, which is where you do for another person what they cannot do for themselves, but need in order to thrive. And they only do for you what you cannot do for yourself, but need in order to thrive. You each bring the value added to the relationship. And what you end up with is more than what either one of you had to begin with, and something different.
Yeah, makes sense. You know, and that creates the harmony as well. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was that's the other big piece of your introductory
comment. I'm a Libra.
Yes. Working hard and making harmony.
I should put some Beach Boys in here, speaking of harmony.
Yes. So I'm gonna take an early transition. Let's play another song, and then I want to come to a different set of questions. What should we play next?
Let's go down the list. We'll do the Lionel Hampton song.
Okie doke. Drinking wine, Spoodie O'Dee. Yeah, Spoodie O'Dee. Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Peter Beecraft. So Peter, where I like to go next is this. I'm going to ask like two or three different kinds of questions, and it's your choice where we go with this. How have you taken a risk and failed and learned something you would never have learned? That's one way of taking the question. The other way is, how has life forced you to let go of something you valued in order to do something else that proved to be important? How has life been better than you imagined that it would have been? How has it defied your expectations in a positive way? So those are all three ways of getting at how have you had to change in unexpected ways?
Right. Now you're making me think.
I know, that's a dangerous thing with people. You start thinking and then things get really interesting.
Let's get back to maybe the last question was the easiest one.
Yeah.
The first question failed, right? How have I failed to at something?
We had to pick yourself. I mean, in a certain sense, having the goal to go to college and then realizing this is not work, it's a minor failure.
Yeah. Well, when I went to grad school, I went to, that's what brought me to New York right. City. I left the program, I was, I didn't make my second, review. You know, I left it because they asked me to leave, you know, and that was definitely a shock. It was a shock. I can look at it now and see, I can understand why, but at the time I didn't. Whoa. At the time I was invested. Now I can understand.
Yeah. So I know that, I mean, it may even still be a sensitive topic on some level, but what I want to understand is by taking what became a failed risk, did that make you less afraid of risk?
I don't know if it made me less afraid of risk, because I've always had this mantra. Well, not really a mantra, but my mother always told me that to learn, to grow, you need to take risks. Mm-hmm. And so I've always kept that motto with me, you know. I don't think it made me afraid to take risks. That situation there probably just knocked me off my horse for a bit in terms of confidence. Right. Yeah. Right.
And when you live through a failure, the failures that you learn from are big enough that you notice. Because some people have failures that they don't even see that way, and they keep tootling on down the road. But the failures, the other end of the spectrum, failures that you don't learn from, they're so big that you become, in a sense, ashamed and don't know how to get back up on the horse again.
Right. I think what I learned from that was even though I viewed myself as something, maybe I wasn't up to the task of being that title. Yes, as a person, I'm artistic, but being a fine artist wasn't what I was cut out to be, even though I thought that was it. And since that, what I do now, I've been able, I really feel like that this is how I am best expressed as an artist, in terms of You know, I had in art school, I had a teacher that said almost on the very first day, you know, one, take a look around your class here. There's a small percentage of you that are actually going to make it. Right. Okay. And then he said, the other thing he said was, you know, the average viewer in a gallery looks at a work for about 7 seconds before they move on to the next. What are you going to do to capture them for more than 7 seconds? And I feel like now I do that. Actually, I capture them for an evening, you know, or a whole dinner. And I've got, I'm doing what I'm doing now. I can reach more people than I ever could have, as a fine artist.
Right. And it seems like, I mean, when you talk, and I've interviewed now, you're probably the eighth or ninth winemaker I've interviewed. When you talk about it, it's also a craft. And for a lot of people who are fine arts oriented, they are so caught up in the uniqueness of it and the wholeness of it and inevitably the ego of it. And that loses the relational piece.
Yeah. Yeah. There is that. Yeah. And crafts are, the craft is, actually looked down upon and
I know,
because it's not singular. It's not unique. But it is used. It is utilitarian. It is, it sees more people.
Right. Or if you are a carpenter or a builder and you have to handle a fairly unusual transition in a stairway, you may come up with a design that is unique, that's almost in some sense patentable, but you only get paid for that one time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you still have the art and the craft, and people will use it for decades, if not centuries. So I understand the pecking order of status. Craft is belittled under high art, fine art. But.
And yes, there is a craft in the winemaking, and yet it is a commodity. It is a collectible.
Yep.
As well, you know, in its finest form. Yeah. You know, it can be so. And also it can be every day.
So you can hit it out of the ballpark some years with a wine or two, and you can just keep putting the wine on the table.
Sure. And yes. But you know what it does? It makes people happy. Yeah. You know, and the end result is, you know, I'm creating something that brings joy to people's life.
And how do you experience their joy?
I experience their joy through seeing that, through seeing that enjoyment, also through you know, I don't get to go home with everybody to see that, but you know, the fact that they come back, you know, that helps. The fact that that they let us know that they like it, that helps as well. You know, the fact that we have people that want to join our club.
Right. Right.
To keep getting it. I mean, those are ways that's how I know that they're enjoying it. I also know that people don't enjoy it. So, you know, and that is, you have to accept that as well. You have to accept that people these are subjective things, right?
Right.
Taste. And you know, my life has been in this kind of subjective world as well. So you know, but I can't really concentrate too much on that.
Or you can acknowledge it and see where the choices or the tastes or the palate are just different.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
And that's a good thing to know too. I want to to go back to something you said. You said earlier that you like to be a teacher and you like to foster. And foster, I didn't know whether that meant animals or children or foster learning or foster, you know. So in that role, are you training winemakers or are people apprenticing with you, or how do you live that part of your role? Now that you're in the position to judge the artist.
Right. People do apprentice with me. Yeah. I'm presently going to be interviewing for some assistance. You know, what I do here. You know, it's getting back to a collaboration. You know, it's myself and an assistant who pretty much take care of you know, the whole year, with a little bit of help during the harvest when it gets busy. But essentially it's two of us creating. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was an assistant at one time. I was a mentor or mentored. I was an apprentice, you know. And really, you know, that was really one of the first times I ever had a mentor. I missed it in school.
Mm-hmm.
I never really had a mentor. I had people that were assigned as a mentor, but I don't know if they really mentored me. I wasn't learning from them in the way that I felt like what you're telling me means something. Okay. But you know, when I learned winemaking, you know, I was mentored, I was encouraged. And I just want to pass that along. I like pass that along pass it forward in a way.
And you're making me see something that, or at least this is what I see, maybe you don't intend it, but many of us grew up in homes where we were formed or we were not formed as persons. And your parents seem to regard that freedom and that curiosity and that taking things on, and they kept track of you.
Yeah.
And they wanted you to do that. And they supported you in even things that they would never have imagined, as you have supported others. But apprenticeships can be that kind of formation, rather than just letting people do their time through, you know, 12 years public schools and 4 years of college and grad school and or whatever professional training you go into. You're not trained, but you're mentored, and that's a different kind of relationship.
Yeah, it is, and it's practical and it's hands on.
Right. And how do you relate? How does it change the way you relate to the person when it's their formation as a winemaker that matters more than, in some sense, more than some abstract technical skill?
I'm viewing that position, because I've been there, mm-hmm. as a launching pad, as a springboard, if they're absolutely passionate about it, to doing what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to see that happen. I want to see them. I don't, you know, that position isn't a lifelong position. You know, it's a stage.
Right.
And I want that person to, one, you know, I don't know everything, but I have some life experience. And I know what I know here, in terms of, like, I'm not a scientist, right? There's a very scientific aspect to winemaking as well. I know what I know, and you know, I can make do. You know, the wines are sound, right?
Right, but and you backed up. You don't just make do, you make it.
Yeah.
and you make it together with everybody who's working the soil and the fields and bringing the grapes in and they're pressing and all the various stages of handling the juice and the wine. But we live in a culture where that pride of craft often, it takes time to see it. It takes time to appreciate it. And so what do you look at in terms of passion? What are you looking at both in yourself as your own passion evolves over time? And what are you looking at for, or looking for in people who come to you as apprentices?
I think if you love what you're doing, you want to be doing it all the time. And you wake up and you look forward to doing what you're doing. Because I think that you have, in that situation, you are happy to get up.
They don't have to pay you to get up.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And so with people that I apprentice or apprentice under me, I'm looking for somebody that wants to be doing what they're doing. Maybe they haven't discovered their true passion for it, but the fact that they've at least come to me means one, that they are passionate, and two, that they have drive.
Right.
Drive is something that you can't teach. You have it, or you don't.
Yeah.
And if you have those two things, I can then work with that. I can help you, and I know that you can help me as well.
Right.
Yeah. And I can teach you the rest.
Right.
What you need to know. And then part of that also, a winemaker's greatest tool is, their sense of smell and taste. When the books fail you, you have your sense of smell and taste, which is why, these are very important right now. I'm holding a mask, right?
Yeah.
Because if I lost that, I'd lose, I don't know how I'd so the rest can be taught, but if you have those two things, I know that one, you're teachable and that you're willing to learn.
Sure. And drive is a really interesting thing, because it can come off as high energy. It can come off as almost no energy, but just a steady force to be reckoned with. Drive manifests itself in a lot of different ways, and how do you scope that out?
Yeah.
Or it may not be conscious. That may not be a good question, but it's a complex thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think this is a great time to cut to the summer wine song, if that would be good for you. Here we go.
Strawberries, cherries, and an angel's kiss in spring. My summer wine is really made from all these things.
I walk in town on silver spurs that jingle too. A song that I had only sang to just a few. She saw my silver spurs and said, let's pass some time, and I will give to you summer wine. Oh, summer wine.
Strawberries, cherries, and an angel's kiss in spring. My summer wine is really made from all these things. Take off your silver spurs and help
me pass the time, and I will give to you summer wine. Oh, summer wine.
My eyes grew heavy and my lips, they could not speak. I tried to get up, but I couldn't find my feet. She reassured me with an unfamiliar line, and then she gave to me more summer wine. Oh, summer wine.
Strawberries, cherries, and kissing spring. My summer wine is really made from all these things. Take off your silver spurs and help me pass the time, and I will give to you summer wine. Summer wine.
Sun was shining in my eyes. My silver spurs were gone. My head fell twice its size. She took my silver spurs, a dollar and a dime, and left me craving for more summer wine. Oh, summer wine.
Strawberries, cherries, and an angel's kiss in spring. My summer wine is really made from all these things. Take off those silver spurs and help me pass the time, and I will give to you my summer wine. Summer
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Peter B. Kraft. So Peter, the way I like to end the show is with a reflection on what you do to take care of yourself. Maybe how, you know, when you learned that one of the major responsibilities in life was for you to take care of yourself, but also what you do physically, intellectually, emotionally, which for me add up to spiritually, to be fully present and accounted for, and to make adjustments when you're not.
Yeah, things that I do for my health, right? Or for my well-being. Yeah,
Your well-being, your wholeness.
Yeah. Well, a couple things. In terms of actual, I run. I also run / walk, but that's a great exercise. I have a 12-year-old son, and when he was a year and a half, almost 2 years old, he had an allergic reaction to cashews, and it was the scariest moment in my life. And my wife had allergies, and she could see what was happening, right? And luckily she was there. She was the calm one. But after that, it was maybe within a couple months, it triggered anxiety in me, and I didn't know what I was dealing with. Things get foggy. Things get, and what's happening is you're getting, you know, I, you're getting fearful because you're losing control, and your body wants to be in control, and then your mind starts running, and there's a fear, and I didn't know what was happening, and until you know I had a doctor that said, well, I think you're suffering from anxiety maybe, and then I you know was spoke with a therapist who then told me you know helped me with some tools on how to deal when to deal with that. And so part of that was exercise.
Yep.
And part of that was meditation, which, you know, I don't do, you know, TM or anything like that. I'm by any means, but part of that is concentrating, making sure that you're breathing. Yep. Right. And taking that time to concentrate and meditate on that to make sure that, you know, you're in the here and now. I try to do that. And the exercise part, you know, I took up running, I hadn't exercised like that probably in, you know, like 15, 20 years. And, but it's never too late. It's never too late. I love soccer. I love watching soccer. I love watching European soccer, world soccer. That to me is very meditative. Mm-hmm. Kind of like, you know, people like to watch golf.
But the artistry of soccer is just amazing. Yeah.
I love, especially, you know, really fluid play. I'm just mesmerized by that. And then I also like, from that, I'm intrigued by the team chemistry and how everybody fits into a certain position and the hopefully the strength of the manager and I can find a lot of I look towards that in doing what I'm doing. I get a lot of inspiration from that. I love music. I've always loved music. You know, listening to it brings me great pleasure.
Do you perform?
I don't perform, but I do have a guitar. You know, I strum, but I I'm not a performer.
Well, actually, I don't even really mean a performer. I mean, when you sing for 5 to 7 minutes, it's the same as doing a meditation.
Yeah.
In terms of the effect on your body.
Well, when I play, I'm lost for sure. Yeah, you get lost, and that is that. It definitely gives you a feeling that you can not get from a lot of activities. You know, I found a couple years ago I wasn't reading as much. You know, the way that we live our lives these days with you know, phones and TV and things like this. I felt like, wow, you know, I used to read a lot. I'm not reading anymore. Joined a book club with some guys. That's been really, really, that forces me to read, right? Yeah. Now I have to read. And it forces me to read out of my comfort zone, you know? Because, you know, it would just be soccer and music books and maybe some wine books. But this, you know, has forced me to do that. And I really enjoy that. Being present with my family, you know, with my son, with my wife, gardening, that brings me pleasure. Going down to the lake when we can. I live on Seneca Lake, swimming in the lake during the summer, seeing the enjoyment that it brings my son. You know, he's 12, but when he's in the water, it's almost like he's 5. You know, there's a disconnect. You know, he loses that sense of himself on shore when he's there, and there is sort of that you know, forever young that comes out that is I just love.
He's abandoning himself in play.
Yeah,
and that always looks like it's 2 to 6 years of age.
Yeah, and I I love that so much. Yeah. Yeah.
So I want to a couple of things. One, relationally, your touchstones are family in terms of the recharging your relational batteries. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm sensing. And how do you take care of your, I mean, what I'm getting at here is most people do their emotional self-care in their relationships with others. Mm-hmm. And that's a little bit of what I'm hearing. What I wanted to go back to with that was when you had the anxiety response after the allergic reaction to cashews, was that your fear of your son dying?
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. And also probably a fear that it was going to happen again, and right. that I didn't know what to do.
Right.
And you know, so after that, let's say anytime there's a blank stare, or my son's quiet. Are you okay? What's wrong? Are you, everything, and then you're just sitting there waiting, right, for it to happen again.
Right.
Or you're something living, else.
Yeah. You're
so yeah, that, there are people that, that live with children or family members that have far worse situations. I mean, severe situations, say like epilepsy or something like that.
Right.
Severe, I couldn't imagine. Mm-hmm. I really couldn't imagine the sense of you're always waiting.
Right, right. And one of the things that my father died when I was 7, and when my daughter was approaching, say, 2 years or so from that age, where she would be that age, and I began to fear her death, but also I think it was in a weird way of kind of reliving some of my experience as a child who lost his father. And the discipline that took me out of that was, it's going to sound really odd here, but to spiritually imagine that she had died and to come and to let myself grieve that, because I was too invested in raising her. We were totally tight as father and daughter in those early years. And at that point, when I could let her go, then she could have her own life in a powerful way without my being fearful for her. Now, there was no precipitating incident where she had an allergic reaction or anything. It was just all my projection of my stuff onto her. But these are many of the ways that we learn how to let our children grow
and
be themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And that kind of comes full circle to, what I was hinting at with my parents and me.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to do that. And I think that because I had that, guidance there, I want to in turn do it with my son as well. And it's also kind of my job as a winemaker too. I don't force these wines, right? My job is to really let them express the vintage. And so, I guide them. I can, believe me, if I need to, I'll step in, right? Mm-hmm. But
you might do as much damage as you do good, just depending upon the specific moment or intervention in the process.
I mean, if the fruit is good, the resulting wine should be good as well,
right.
And so it won't take as much of my input. Now I know what I want, and I know what it can be, and so that's what I try to do as a winemaker, and I think that's what we do. And both my wife and I, in raising our son, to let him have his own interests. Our sense that we both love music, right? But my son only listens to hip hop. Only at this moment.
Yep.
In time, and I'm not getting in the way because he loves it. And he's so passionate about it. And I remember when I was his age, the music I listened to, you know, my parents didn't listen to either. And this is common. This is a common story, right? It would be wrong of me to say, you know, only the Beatles were good, right? Because that's not the truth.
Right.
Peter, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Yeah. Well, it took a while for this to happen, but I'm glad that you were persistent.
Yeah.
And thanks for keeping on me to make this happen.
You're very welcome. Shall we close with yesterday's wine?
Let's do it. Yeah.
Willie Nelson.
Just play it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Miracles appear in the strangest of places. Fancy meeting you here. The last time I saw you was just out of Houston. Sit down, let me buy you a beer. Your presence is welcome with me and my friend here. This is a hangout of mine. We come here quite often and listen to music, partaking of yesterday's wine. Yesterday's wine, I'm yesterday's wine, aging with time. Like yesterday's wine. Yesterday's wine. We're yesterday's wine. Aging with time. Like yesterday's wine. You give the appearance of one widely traveled. I'll bet you've seen things in your time. So sit down beside me and tell me your story. If you think you'll like yesterday's wine. Yesterday's wine. We're yesterday's wine. Aging with time. Like yesterday's wine. Yesterday's wine. Well, yesterday's wine. Aging with time. Like yesterday's wine. Yesterday's wine, we're yesterday's wine. Aging with time, like yesterday's wine. Yesterday's wine, we're yesterday's wine. We're aging with time. Like yesterday's wine.